We are starting a new series starting today called The Prodigal. And as I think about this story, I want to ask you a quick question. How many of you, when you were a kid, how many of you ran away from home or snuck out of the house? Raise your hand. It's okay. Your mom's not here. Okay. We can admit it now. So when I was a kid, I snuck out a lot, especially in seventh grade. Nothing good. All right. Nothing good. No good intention of sneaking out. But my parents didn't know about it. And everything was going fine until one night I was walking back to my house after prowling around the neighborhood and wherever else I went with my friends. And I'm getting ready to go back in my window sill and getting ready to go back to my window. And I saw my cat. Sometimes, you know, some cat late at night, they just kind of have a wild-eyed look. And I'm just going, what's going on? His name is Quincy. I'm like, what's wrong with Quincy? Because he would just run up the tree and run down the tree. He was just kind of going, you know, spastic. And I was just like, what's going on with my cat? I don't know what happened to him tonight, but... And so I'm going back in my my room, and I open up my window, and I look in my peripheral vision. I can see my cat is in the air. He is trying to get back in the house. And I'm not going to allow that to happen because he's going to do something stupid, and it's going to wake up my parents. And so I try to body block him, but I was a little late on the draw. All it did was he ricocheted off my shoulder, hit the lamp, knocked it off the desk, and made a big sound. And I'm sitting there just frozen like this, standing outside my room like this, just didn't want to make a noise. And all of a sudden, I saw the lights come on the hallway. And then all of a sudden, the door opens up, and my lights are coming on. And I'm standing there just like this, outside, all right, and looking into my room. And my dad opens the door, and he asks the questions all parents ask, and that is, what are you doing? And my answer is the answer that all kids have given over since, you know, kids ever came in the world. And my answer was what? My answer was, I don't know. Total lie. Total lie. I knew exactly what I was doing. And so I get back in my room, and I sit on my bed, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just, you know, I'm caught, right? Kind of rocking a hard place. And my parents asked me, what were you doing out there? And I'm trying to figure out what answer can I give them that I won't get in trouble for. And I had the answer, because I'm a good church kid. I said, Mom, Dad, I was going down to the park because I'm thinking about getting baptized. And you could tell they're like, he is so lying, you know, but they couldn't. And so what they did, the best punishment they can come up with, and that is, you know, have me meet with my student pastor for 2 months straight, all right, and trying to figure out what was really going on that night. But all of us have our running away stories. Aren't you glad that as adults we outgrow this? There's part of us that just wants to run. And today we kick off the series that Charles Dickens said is the best story ever told. So go ahead and open up your Bibles to Luke. Gospel Luke is the third gospel in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke. Luke chapter 15. And you might sing your head, or it might say something like this, the parable of the lost son. Or it might say the prodigal son. But I want you to know those two are big mistakes because I believe the story is more than just about one son. In fact, look at the context. Starting in verse 11, it says, there was a man who had how many sons? He had how many sons? He had two sons. And what I want to do is I want to call this series... And not just series, but I would like to head this section up of scripture, say the parable of the two lost sons. That's really what it is, a parable of the two lost sons. Both of these sons are drastically lost, but I'm getting ahead of myself. We're going to talk about the younger, we're going to talk about the older son, and we're going to talk about the father eventually, all leading up to Easter. But I'm going to promise you this series, whether you've heard this story or not, a couple things. One is you're going to learn something new. You're going to learn something new. And number two is I believe that God is going to use this series to transform someone's life. So let's start off at the beginning. Why in the world did Jesus tell the story? Because context is very, very important. Well, let's look and see what's going on. Verse 1, it says, now the tax collectors and what? Say it with me. And what? Sinners were doing what? They were all gathering around to hear Jesus. See, wherever Jesus went, there was always a crowd. And sometimes I hear people say, I can't stand crowds. Well, you would not have liked hanging around Jesus because there was always a crowd around Jesus. And in the crowd, there were sinners and there were tax collectors. Think of the worst of the worst. In context, for us in Jacksonville, as Jacksonville Jaguar fans, think of Tennessee Titan fans, okay, the worst of the worst. I mean, I love it when it says they were gathering because that's the present progressive tense Greek verb, meaning that this didn't just happen once. This happened all the time. It was always happening. They were always gathering around Jesus. Jesus was always having the worst of the worst around him in society. And this convicts me in my core because I have to ask myself this question. How did Jesus, the only perfect person in history, manage to always attract notoriously imperfect people? How did that happen? How he's perfect, and yet he's always attracting imperfect people. And I think to myself as a pastor, and I want you to know, I am far from perfect. But do people who are far from God want to be around me? Do they want to be around our church? Do they want to be here? Because that's the environment that Jesus created. And I get convicted because when I get around people who are far from God, I realize I have my work cut out for me because many of them haven't been hurt by a church. They've been hurt by a pastor. And how in the world do I treat them in a way just as Jesus would? And it's challenging. It's challenging. How do I be like Jesus in this area? I'll give you an example. Many of you know I like to golf. And several times in my 20-plus years of golfing, sometimes I'll just go out by myself and get paired up with random people. And I love that because I get to meet people in the community, oftentimes who don't want anything to do with Jesus. They don't want anything to do with Christianity. And so usually in the first four holes, somebody hits a bad shot, and you hear, son of a bleep, you know, you hear the words start flying out of the gate. And then around, I don't know, holes 5 to 8, they will turn to ask me, so Nathan, what do you do for a living? And I tell them, you can see their brain starts inverting inside their head a little bit. I had one woman, I was golfing with a couple one time, and the wife says, I've been telling him for years to watch his language. So to make them feel better, my next bad shot, I'll just say a bad word. I'll just let it fly. I'm kidding. I don't hit bad shots. That's a lie. That's a lie. I'll go ahead and confess that now. But anyway, seriously, I want to change the narrative so that people who are really far from God feel comfortable and want to be around people who are followers of Jesus. And that's what Jesus showed us. And I want you to know this. I want you to know, when we make decisions here at RCC, we don't always make decisions through the lens of what's going to make Christians happy. We're always asking ourselves this question when we make decisions. How are we going to reach the lost? How are we going to reach the lost? How are we ever going to change our community if they don't feel comfortable coming and being part of a church to hear about Jesus? And oftentimes that makes Christians angry because they think it should be all about them. They think it should be a country club, you know, for Christians rather than a hospital for sinners. And one thing I've always respected about RCC leadership over the last 9 years is decisions are made not based on what's going to make people happy, but based on how we're going to reach this lost world. That's what drives us, and that's what keeps us up at night. And by the way, sometimes that makes people mad, and it did in Jesus' day too. Look at the very next verse, and let's see how the religious elite respond to Jesus hanging out with the worst of the worst. Look what it says. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, they did what? Say it with me. They did what? They muttered. Muttered, muttered. You're going to hear it, right? Muttered. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Eating with them means that he welcomed them. So when Jesus saw the response of religious people, he was so disgusted by it that he told three stories to kind of get up in their grill. And what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the last of those stories in this series. And I'm going to kind of summarize it for you. Starting in verse 11, here's what it says. Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to the father, Father, give me my share of the inheritance or the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off to a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. Later on, we hear that he squandered it on prostitutes and who knows what. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who put him to work feeding pigs. That's the lowest of the low in Jewish society. He longed to fill his stomach with pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And when he, look at this, say it with me, when he did what? When he came to his senses, that's a very important point right there. He said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and get back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And he did what? Say it with me. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, kissed him. And then the son said, Father, he rehearsed his speech so many times. Father, I have sinned and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And the father stops him and puts a coat on him and puts the ring on his finger, which means that he's back in the family, that he is considered one of the sons. And then the father throws the biggest party the village has ever seen. And while the party's going on, the older son is out in the field because he's all about perfection. And he's so disgusted by his dad that he received his younger son and his younger brother back. And the dad goes out there and he just says, Dad, I have worked for you my whole life and you haven't given me anything. You've never thrown a party like that for me. And the dad says to his older son, he says, Son, everything I own is yours. Everything I own is yours. And the story ends on a cliffhanger. But today, I want to focus on how we're like the younger son today. And the first thing I want to talk to you about is we've all run from God, and we've all done something scandalous. We all have. We read this story, you go, what's so scandalous about what he did? He just kind of took off from home for a while and spent some money. Well, you got to look at it not through the American lens, but through the original audience, the Jewish lens. You need to know this story was super scandalous. When Jesus told the story, people lost their living minds, especially with the part when the younger son went to the dad while the dad was still alive and says, I want my inheritance. Like the Jewish audience would have lost their marbles on that one. And you might go, well, what's the big deal? Why is that such a big deal? I'll tell you why. There's a Middle Eastern historian by the name of Kenneth Bailey, and he wrote this. In all of Middle Eastern literature, aside from this parable, from ancient times to present, there is no case of any son, older or young, asking for his inheritance from a father who is still in good health. Now, in that society, a father would pass down his inheritance after he died to his older son, who would get double portion, and then to the next son, and they would do that. But never in a culture would you ask for the inheritance while the father was still alive. Why? Because you're basically wishing that your dad was dead. You're saying, you know what? I don't love you for who you are, Dad. I love you for what I can get out of you. I wish you were dead. In fact, Kenneth Bailey has spent 40 years in the Middle East. He's all the way from Morocco to India, from Turkey down Sudan. And he asked them a question, oftentimes when he's traveling over 40 years in any country in the Middle East. And he says, could any, you know, son ever ask and make a request to have their inheritance while their dad is still alive? And the answer he gets is never. So the question then is next, like, oh, can anyone make that request? And the answer is always impossible. And he goes, well, what would happen if someone did make that request to their dad? And the answer is their dad would beat them and disown them. And that's convicting to me in my life because I think, how many times have I wished that God were dead? And you're like, well, that kind of sounds rough. What do you mean, Pastor, that you wish God were dead? Well, how many times in my life have I said, God, I don't want you to make any demand on my life. I don't want you to tell me what to do with my sexuality, with my morality, with my finances. And what are you saying? God, I don't want you in my life. I want you dead. And in many ways, that's our culture. Our culture is running away from God. We don't want God to say anything about our life. We just wish that he were dead. In fact, someone sent me a link years ago of a YouTube of someone talking about the way they're living their life, decisions they're making, and I want to quote to you what they said. They said, I want to be my own person. I want to be my own individual, my own human being. I want my own identity. I want a life with no rules, no labels, and no restrictions. And that describes our culture pretty well, doesn't it? That's what our culture's doing. We're running away from God, and we want no rules, we want no restrictions, and no one gets to tell me what to do about anything. And that's what the son did. He ran to a distant land. He thought, you know what? I want no restrictions. I want to do whatever I want. And he thought that was going to make him happy. And maybe for you, it's not going to a distant land, but for you, it was your freshman year in college, or that spring break, or maybe that addiction, or that affair, or that time you ran from your wife and went to pornography. It might be your financial decisions, or it could be for some that belief that you don't need church at all. You're running. I love what Henry Nouwen said. He said, I am the prodigal son. Every time I search for unconditional love, where it cannot be found. We go looking for love in all the wrong places, don't we? And so the next question is this. So like, why else do we run? Why do we run? Well, number two is this. We run because we think God is restricting us, don't we? Just like that we talked about earlier. God is going to hold me back from all the fun in life. I want no rules, no restrictions. That's how I'm going to live a happy life. Which sounds good until it's not. I mean, sin is fun. And if you're not having fun sinning, you're doing it wrong, okay? So it's fun. Until it's not. Until there's the consequences. Until that sting of pain on the other side. And when we do our life where we do our own thing, where it's fun in the moment, and then we have to deal with the consequences later, which always leads to destruction if we don't stop, you can end up in a place you thought you would never be. In fact, some of you say that. We've all ended up in a place we thought, we never thought we would be, right? I mean, I've been in places physically where I'm like, how did I end up here? It caused a decision. I was running from God. Relationship, how did I end up in this relationship? Well, I was running from God. Some of you are there right now. I don't know how in the world I got here, you're saying to yourself. Step by step, you were running away and doing your own thing from God because you didn't want any restrictions. You didn't want anyone to say that what you were doing was wrong. You definitely didn't want somebody from God to tell you about anything you were doing. So we run. And we're like the younger son. But the other question that comes to my mind is this. What do we learn about God when we're on the run? Well, here's one thing you learn. When you run from God, God won't always stop you. He won't. And some of you are like, why not? Why won't God just stop me? Well, because he loves you. That's why. You have to understand something, and that is you cannot have love without the freedom to accept or reject. Think about it. If you're married or want to be married one day, would you want your spouse to lock you up in a house and never allow you to leave the house, ever? Some of us are like, that sounds awesome. But no, that would be terrible, okay? That'd be a prison is what that would be. That'd be slavery. God loves you so much, the power of love is giving you the power of choice, and that is to love or to accept or reject him. God wants an adventure. He wants a relationship with you, a relationship that requires that you have to accept or choose to seek God. And if you choose to reject God, by the way, God will let you. And guess what? Here's the second thing. God won't always shield you from the pain of your choices. God won't always shield you from the pain of your choices. Now, some of you are in pain because what somebody else did. And I'm sorry about that. But many of us are in pain right now because of choices that we have made. God will not shield you from that pain. In fact, God will let you run and exhaust yourself. And I'm going to tell you right now, some of us are on a treadmill. We're just chasing after something other than God. And what's going to happen eventually on this treadmill is you're going to get exhausted. No, the only thing you need in your life to find life is to turn back to God and say, God, I am so tired. And I've done this. I'm so tired of doing it my way because it's led me into this pit. I want to do it your way. And so my question this morning is, are you tired? Are you tired of running? And when you get tired and you know your life's not going the way it should and how it's designed, why does it take for some of us so long to come back home? Why does it take some of us so long to come back home? I think there's a number of reasons. One is that we just, you know, you look at this guy and he's eating, like, he's feeding the pigs and he wants to eat what the pigs are eating. You're thinking, why doesn't he just go home? I think some of us don't go home right away because, you know, what we've done, we don't think God will take us back. And if I could summarize it in one word, I think that one word is shame. We feel so much shame because we're just not sure if we're going to be accepted again after all we have done. Jesus' original audience, they know exactly why that young man did not go home right away. In fact, they had this law at the time, Jewish law in the Talmud, that was basically, if you were someone who took the inheritance and then you wasted the inheritance while living, you are to be shunned from the community forever. And they would just make you feel so much shame, they would cut you off. And this ceremony was called kazaza. Kazaza. Everybody say kazaza on the count of three. One, two, three. Kazaza. So basically what it is the young man's trying to come home, and they would take a pot like this, and it would be filled up a whole bunch of burnt herbs and nuts and peas and beans, and it just smelled up to high heaven. It just stank. Basically saying that what you have done is so vile to us, so putrid to us, that there's no way we can have you come back. And so as that young man is trying to come back in the community, somebody was standing out with this huge pot like this of just all this smelly, rank stuff. And right before him, as he's approaching, with the whole community behind the person with the pot, what they would do with the pot, they would do this. They'd go. Basically saying, what you have done is so shameful. We are forever broken off from you. And as that smell comes up, the goal is obviously to drive him away. It was a ceremony to make sure that he knew he was totally cut off forever. And some of us feel like that's what God's done to us. We feel like there's a vase out there with our name on it. And that God has slammed down the vase and all this nastiness that we did is back in our face. And he's saying, that's right. You're forever broken. And that's why some of us right now don't want to come back to God, because of shame. We feel like God has done that to us. And that's why so many of us wait. That's why so many of us are not heading back to God right now. But if you're running away from God, I want you to listen to me right now. You'll never overcome the brokenness of your life until you come home to his love. You'll never overcome the brokenness of your life until you come home to his love. See, the scandal of the story is not just that the father accepted him, but that the father ran. He ran to that boy. He ran to that son. And most people heard the story thought this was going to happen. But Jesus, in the story, the prodigal son, told us and showed us how God is. God's not that way. In fact, I want to read to you a story from a book called What's So Amazing About Grace. The staff and I read this together in 2023. It's from Philip Yancey. And here's what he writes. A young girl grew up in a cherry orchard outside Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents, a bit old-fashioned, tend to overreact to her nose ring and music she listens to and the length of her skirts. They ground her a few times, and she seethes inside. She yells out, "I hate you." She screams at her father when he knocks on the door of her room after an argument. And that night, she acts on a plan that she has mentally rehearsed scores of times. She runs away from home. She heads to Detroit. She's only been there once. And newspapers of Traverse City always are reporting shocking details about gangs and drugs and violence in downtown Detroit. She concludes that Detroit is the last place on earth her parents will look for her. Her second day there, she meets a man who drives the biggest car she's ever seen. He offers her a ride, buys her lunch, arranges a place for her to stay. He gives her some pills that make her feel better than she's ever felt before. She was right all along, she decides. Her parents were keeping her from all the fun. The good life continues for a month, another month, for a year. The man with the big car, she called him boss, teaches her a few things. Since she's underage, men pay a premium for her, and she lives in a penthouse and orders room service whenever she wants. Occasionally, she thinks about her folks back home, but their lives now seem so boring that she can hardly believe she even grew up there. She has a brief scare when she sees her photo printed on the back of a milk carton with the headline, "Have you seen this child?" But by now, she has blonde hair with all the makeup, body-piercing jewelry she wears. Nobody would ever mistake her for a child. After a year, the first signs of her illness start to appear, and it amazes her how fast the boss turns mean. And before she knows it, she's on the street without a penny to her name. She still turns a couple of tricks a night, but they don't pay much, and all the money goes to support her habit. And then winter blows in, and she finds herself sleeping on metal grates outside the big apartment store. Sleeping is probably the wrong word. A teenage girl at night in downtown Detroit can never relax her guard. Her cough worsens. And one night as she lies awake listening for footsteps, all of a sudden everything about her life looks different. She no longer feels like a woman in the world. She feels like a little girl lost in a cold and frightening city, and she begins to cry. Her pockets are empty. She's hungry. She needs a fix. And she pulls her legs underneath her and shivers under the newspapers that are piled up atop her coat. Something jolts her memory. A single image fills her mind of May in Traverse City. God, why did I leave? She says to herself, and the pain stabs her in her heart. My dog eats better at home than I do now. She's sobbing, and she knows in a flash that more than anything else in the world, she just wants to go home. Three straight phone calls, three straight connections to voicemail. She hangs up without leaving a message the first two times. But the third time, she says, Dad, Mom, it's me. I was wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way, and it'll get there midnight tomorrow. And if you're not there, well, I guess I'll just stay on the bus until it hits Canada. It takes about 7 hours for the bus to make all the stops between Detroit and Traverse City. And during that time, she realizes the flaws in her plan. What if her parents were out of town? Shouldn't she have waited another day or so until she could talk to them? Or if they're home, they probably wrote her off as dead long ago. She should have given them some time to overcome the shock. Her thoughts bounce back and forth between worries and the speech that she's going to give to her dad. She says, Dad, I'm so sorry. She's rehearsing this, and I know I was wrong. It's not your fault. It's all mine. Dad, can you forgive me? She says those words over and over her throat tightens. Even as she rehearses those words, she hasn't apologized to anyone in years. And when the bus rolls into the station, its air brakes hissing, the driver announces in a crackly voice over the microphone, 15 minutes, that's all we have here. 15 minutes to decide her life. She checks herself with a mirror and combs her hair. She walks into the terminal not knowing what to expect. Not one of the thousand scenes that have played out in her mind prepare her for what she sees. There in the terminal stands a group of 40 brothers and sisters and great aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents. They're all wearing these goofy party hats and blowing noisemakers. And taped across the entire wall of the terminal is a banner that says, Welcome home. And now the crowd breaks her dad. And she stares out through the tears quivering in her eyes. And she begins her memorized speech. Dad, I'm sorry. I know. And he just stops her right there and he says, hush, we've got no time for that. No time for apologies. You're going to be late for your party. A banquet is waiting for you back home. We've been waiting for you to come back home. See, the story of the lost younger son is really a story of coming home. And maybe you have been running and you need to know God will take you back. God will take you back. And if you've been running, it's time to come home. In a few weeks, a week after Easter, what we're going to do is we're going to have baptism week. You can actually register for that, riverchristian.church/baptism. And that's a great way to say, God, I'm coming back home. I'm coming back home. I'm coming back to you. And guess what? God will take you back. I want to encourage you to take that step if you've never taken that step before. Some of you are walking with God. But let me ask, when's the last time that you invited someone to come home? When's the last time you sat next to someone who needed to come home? And so my challenge to you this Easter is don't come to Easter alone. Don't come to Easter alone. Don't show up alone. We were designed to be like Jesus. And Jesus is inviting us to invite others to come home. That's why RCC has existed for the last 9 years, and that's what we're going to continue to do, to invite people to come back home. So you're either someone who needs to come home, or you're someone who needs to invite someone to come home? Will you do that this Easter? Will you stand with me? Please stand. Let me pray over you. God, we are so grateful that you're a God who unconditionally loves us. And even God, when we run away from you, God, when we turn our back on you, God, we think we know what's best. But we come to our senses, God, that moment we come to our senses by faith through Jesus. You always, no matter what we've done or how long we've been gone, you always take us back. And Lord, that hope is not just for us, but that hope is for everyone that we know. So Lord, may we be people not only that come back home, but invite people to come back home. So Lord, use us in a mighty way this Easter like never before. And may we have the biggest homecoming ever, all for your glory and all because of what Jesus did for us on the cross. We pray this in his name. The whole church said, amen. If there's a blessing we can be for you, our prayer team is up here. And maybe you have a concern. Maybe you know someone needs to come back home. You want to pray for them. Maybe you do. Just come up. We have a God who's so merciful, so gracious. Can we give him praise right now, church? He's always been faithful. He'll always take us back. Please come right now as we worship him together.